Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, so may I represent the British Council to welcome you all to today's talk, From Journalism to Poetry, by Mr. James Fenton, and will be moderated by Mr. Phil Whelan. Today's event is organized by the British Council in partnership with the Hong Kong Book Fair and the Foreign Correspondents Club. And before the talk commences, may I invite the Director of British Council Hong Kong, Mr. Peter Upton, to say a few words for us. Mr. Upton, please.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. And can I just say, on behalf of the British Council, how delighted we are to be here and in partnership with the FCC. We love technology, but not in this event. So if you've got a mobile phone, please, we'd really like you to put it onto silent mode. Otherwise, we are thinking of charging $500 as a fee to go to charity for any phone that rings. I'm slightly intimidated introducing James Fenton, partly because I love poetry. And it's interesting because this week we've had Anthony Horowitz in town. And when Anthony Horowitz heard the title of this presentation, he said, well, how do you put in one sentence from journalism to poetry? Unfortunately, Anthony is flying out, but he really wanted to be here for this. And one of the things that he wanted to be here for is that we do have somebody quite remarkable in James Fenton. Born in 1949, Lincoln, went to Oxford, and a very interesting experience. When he won his first poetry award, he used the money to go traveling into Southeast Asia and was a freelance reporter for a period of time, went to Cambodia just before the Pol Pot regime. Later on, moved back, wrote more poetry, became the Far East correspondent for The Independent. And he has these two lives. He's well known for his books, The Strength of Poetry, The Love Bomb. He's known, of course, as the Oxford Professor of Poetry. And those of us who like poetry recognize the amazing rhythms, the metrics, and the passion of his poetry. It's got huge range of sort of genres that come through that. In fact, I read one review that I'm not sure he'll like, which said that James Fenton was really like Rudyard Kipling on acid. And I'm not sure who'd be more impressed by that, Rudyard Kipling or James Fenton. But anyway, what it reflected was just this ability to connect. And he's regarded as one of the finest living poets. He's also currently the editor of the Faber Book of Love Poetry. But he's also well known as a journalist based in the Philippines, reporting in the Far East. So it's very appropriate that today we have this event taking place in the FCC, where James has visited and been here before, where it's supported by the FCC, and yet also working with the Council and our commitment to literature, to poetry. We're really privileged that James is here, and that's all you need to hear from me, because actually, you need to hear from the other Peter next, and then you really need to hear from the person who's most important, and that is one of the most impressive living poets in the UK, James Fenton. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter, and I just want to say that we're delighted to be working with the British Council to host today's event. This brings together an unusual and welcome mix of journalists and literary fans into a venue where we don't often bring that combination together. We hope we can do more events like this in the future. So we're thrilled to have James Fenton today. We also would like to remind you of our next event on August 3rd. We will have as a speaker Sam Chambers, who will be talking about his experience in China, covering China's efforts to secure its energy resources and the implications for the rest of the world. But meanwhile, today I will pass you on without further ado to our guest of the afternoon.
So without further delay, we now invite Mr. Fenton and Mr. Whelan to take a seat. And so all over to you now, Phil.
Hong Kong, whoa. Welcome to Hong Kong, James. Good to see you here.
Thank you very much.
We only met a couple of days ago, and I think what we need to do before we get really into this is get to know you a little bit. In the hours we've met each other, I do know you're a very modest man. We sat opposite each other in the radio studio. I threw the obvious couple of overtures at you, which a lot of people would take as an opportunity to reel off their resume. You very modestly sidestepped that. I think we ended up talking about antique shops. So, well done for starters.
Well, that's part of my resume. That's a disgraceful
time. If pushed, which I guess this is what we're here for a little bit this afternoon, I'd like you to tell us all just what you think we need to know about you as a guy. We'll talk about your work in a little while.
You mean me as a guy first?
Personality, things you like, things you don't like.
Oh, right, okay. Well, here we go. My mind goes completely blank when faced with the task of talking about myself. I'll tell you what I started off as. I was a simple person who, as a kid, was really going to be destined for an academic career. And I had it all planned. But I had it all planned up to about the age of 18, and then it all fell to pieces. It fell to pieces at a time when it fell to pieces for quite a lot of people, which is around about 1968, when we all basically took the view that university courses were ridiculous and the politics of our country was ludicrous and that the sooner you could pull down the whole thing, the better. So I also, from an early age, I was going to be a writer. I think right from the word go, I can remember a schoolmaster saying, asking everybody around the class what they were going to be. And say we were all about 10. And at one point, then he looked at me and he said, I think you'll be a writer. And I was very pleased, because that's certainly what I had in mind. But the road to being a writer or being a full-time writer, it was a very circuitous one. And one of the problems that I could never, one of the things I saw as a problem was this, that if you were going to be a poet, obviously you couldn't expect to make money from your poems. You know, if you were lucky and the poem got published, you might get £15 for the newspaper rights. And if you got a book of poems published, you might get an advance of £500. it's not a world that you would ever think of entering if you wanted to make money. But what you certainly could do is you could think about either having a job that related to your writing, i.e. being a literary journalist, doing book reviewing, all the kinds of things that literary writers do. Or you could do something that wasn't so connected. The book I read when I was in this period of decision, a book called Modern Writers on Modern Poetry, had something by W.H. Auden in it. Auden has been a very big influence on my life. And in this, Auden said that for a poet, what you should do is you should have some other thing that you do for your work that is preferably non-literary, he said. For instance, he said to be a carpenter would be very good. Well, Auden never remotely set out to be a carpenter himself, or indeed to follow that kind of advice. He lived by his writing and teaching and so on. But nevertheless, I thought that there was something in this advice. And the thing that I thought that I foresaw as a danger was that I assume that in poetry that it would be something that you write from time to time when the idea comes to you or the mood comes to you or whatever the form of the inspiration is, but you wouldn't be doing it all the time, and there isn't a kind of equivalent of practicing, you know, as you would if you were a musician. There isn't a regular activity. I somewhat felt that if you were spending all your time worrying about when your next book was going to be published, when you would have enough for the next collection, where your stock was as a poet, whether you got recognition or not, what the reviews were like, and so on. If you were worried about all those things and you lived your life in a way that made you have to worry about those things, that would be bad for your poetry. So to have something completely different would be a good idea, although not necessarily being a carpenter. So I thought, as I progressed through, or as I declined through university at Oxford, I thought, well, I'd like to be an anthropologist. So I gave up reading English, because unfortunately, in those days, there wasn't an anthropology degree on offer in Oxford. So then I thought, well, I'll do a degree called PPP, Philosophy, Psychology and Physiology. It was a big mistake in my life, but the most important mistake, because it closed for me the opportunity to be an academic in the English world, in English literature. So I did my PPP degree and did it very badly for the reason I began with it. I was school in 1968. So I ended up with a third class degree and no chance to do the next thing that I thought instead of being an anthropologist. I thought, well, I'll be a clinical psychologist. And I had a third class degree in psychology that I certainly couldn't have gone on to a postgraduate work in a very competitive world of clinical psychology. However, I did have some experience as a journalist, because right at the beginning of my time at Oxford, I'd won a prize that brought me to the attention of the literary editor of the New Statesman. The New Statesman in those days, I could bet that there would be some people in this room who remember the New Statesman in the days of, I think it's greatness, because it was very interested in what was happening to the old colonies, and it was very supportive of the anti-colonial movement over the years. Anyway, I had begun writing for the New Statesman. I'd been given book reviewing to do, fiction reviewing. And so, even when I was an undergraduate, I had become a bit of a journalist. But I'd become, you see, the wrong kind of journalist for my plan. I could be a literary journalist, but I couldn't be what I would consider a real journalist, and to have the kind of job that would be different from my writing. So a real journalist. Is this what you wanted? just stop me if it's all similar to you. A real journalist, I thought, would be a foreign correspondent. That would be absolutely terrific. Well, that's quite a difficult thing to arrange. It's difficult now, it was difficult in those days. And one of the things you were supposed to do as a journalist, as a sort of budding reporter, was you were supposed to go through a training scheme. And that I certainly couldn't get onto, because that was a very competitive world. And the careers officer at Oxford University looked at my CV when I went sort of pleading for help as my catastrophic university career was coming to an end. He said, well, the trouble with you is you're overqualified. And that was absolutely true. I took a book out of the library called Willing's Press Guide, and I wrote to every newspaper north of Birmingham. The reason why I drew a line at Birmingham was I used to live near there, and I lived in Lichfield. I lived in North Wales, and so I thought, that's where I'll get my experience as a reporter. Absolutely nobody answered, excepting a paper called the Stoke Evening Sentinel. The Stoke Evening Sentinel said, we don't have a job for you at the moment, but if ever you're coming through Stoke, do look us up. So I wrote back and said, as it happens, I'm coming through Stoke next week. Which was a lie, but the right kind of lie to set out. But then I called a friend who lived near Stoke and arranged to stay with him, and then went to the offices of the Stoke Evening Sentinel and tried to persuade them to give me a job. No luck. At that point, when I'd drawn a line at sort of half the the newspaper to be assistant literary editor. And it was exactly the wrong kind of job from the point of view of my criteria. But from the point of view of a job opportunity, it was fantastic. So my first job was assistant literary editor of the New Statesman. And it was less grand than it perhaps sounds, but it was extremely interesting. And one day, there came across my desk a letter from the Macedonian Writers Union. And the Macedonian Writers Union were planning, they said, to hold a conference about the Macedonian language question. I knew nothing about Macedonia, and I knew nothing about the Macedonian language. I had no idea what the Macedonian language question might be. Well, it's not much of a mystery. The question is whether Bulgarian and Macedonian are different languages. And I can't remember whether they are or they aren't, but this is the issue. So I wrote to the Macedonian Writers Union, and I said, here at the New Statesman, we're extremely interested in the questions of Macedonia and the Macedonian language question. However, we don't have any money to send anybody, but if you were prepared to support my coming to this conference that you're organizing, I would be extremely happy to put this to my editor, who was a retired Labour politician, the most imposing man, Richard Crossan. I got a letter back from them saying, Yugoslavian currency is not fully convertible, but we can pay you in dinars for your for your expenses, as long as you can put up the money for the ticket in. So it was going to be a complicated thing, but nevertheless. So I then went to Richard Crossan, and I said to him, sir, I've been invited by the Macedonian Writers Union for a conference, a world conference on the Macedonian language question. Do you think I could go? They're going to pay all my expenses. And Crossman, who was under criticism for not actually sending any journalists abroad ever, said, well, okay, go to Macedonia and then go to Belgrade on your way back and write us one piece about the Macedonian language question and one piece about Yugoslavia. So I wrote back and arranged to go to this conference. I arrived at Skopje Airport, was met by the representatives of the Macedonian Writers Union. And I was given an interpreter, a very beautiful woman, and a nice room and so on, and lunch at the Writers Union, which was like a sort of Greek restaurant, the vine and the trellis and people sitting around having drinks in the open air. And after the lunch I said, by the way, when does the conference begin? They said, ah, well, we thought you'd bring that up in the end. They said, we wrote to people all around the world and yours was the only letter that we got in reply. So if you want to know about the Macedonian language question, we can tell you, but there isn't going to be a conference. You are the conference. So that was my first foray into foreign correspondence.
Nice one. I actually meant, what's your favorite color and do you like Lady Gaga? However, just curious though, you're stepping back from a lot of these very, very successful early things in your life. You're all New Statesman, and it wasn't so glamorous, etc. I mean, it's very nice to see that. But what do you now professionally think of the young James Fenton?
What do I think of that?
A different person, you then.
Well, I think that person was, you know, had a certain amount of what you call rat-like cunning, because, as you see, a lot of lies were deployed in order to...
From both sides.
...get the point that I wanted to be at.
Yeah.
I think the question that you're asking turns for me into the question, was the theory good, that you should have one life, one professional life that earns your money for you, and one, and your literary life as a thing apart? And of course, if the theory was wrong, then I just spent my life wrongly. So I'm slightly loath to say the theory was wrong.
Mm.
On the other hand, I think when I look at the people who went a different way, who went into university, did their postgraduate degrees, became teachers of literature, and worked. I can think of many whose careers demonstrate that the theory was wrong. But whether it was wrong for me, that I can't tell you. I think if I'd really applied myself at university, I would have been a good academic. But I would have been a different poet, that's absolutely clear. And whether I would have been a better or a more productive poet, so not a productive poet, that I simply can't answer.
You must have had those sort of quiet thoughts to yourself moments, though, because, I mean, you did hit the ground running. You won a Hefty Prize in your first year, a poetry prize for sonnets. And yes. did you ever say, well, maybe I could earn some money from this? No.
No, I certainly didn't think that. But I thought that I certainly was aware that I'd begun well. And I'll tell you, when I was offered the job on the New Statesman, I took a long time before saying, I mean, I took weeks before saying yes. I thought about it very hard. I thought it was the wrong way to go, and I was worried about doing it. But I did it in the end, because I had nothing else to do. But it's a curious thing. I don't think anybody else would have had that problem. But it hung over me.
Have you resolved it yet?
Sorry?
Have you resolved it yet inside?
No, I don't think I have. I mean, I look back and think, oh, well, you know, what went wrong? That's what I think. But anyway, so what went wrong was the next thing was having done that. That kind of, it made that sort of start. I then took every opportunity that I could on the New Statesman to move from the back half, which was the literary side, to the front half, which was the political side. And that was also partly because, again, being school of 1968, but now we're talking about the early 70s, I was on the left, I was on the far left, and I was interested in politics. And we were much exercised, of course, by the question of Vietnam. That was the big question that hung over our generation. And funnily enough, you've alluded to this, but what actually happened was I put in for a poetry award, which was like a sort of bursary that gave you money to do a project. I wanted just to live for a bit. And it's called the Eric Gregory Award. And I said to them, I want to travel. I want to go to the Far East. I'm thinking of writing a long poem. A long poem never got very far. But the money that I was given in this award, £2,000, a lot of money in those days, was what I used for coming out to Indochina. I thought I was on my way to Vietnam, and indeed I was. But I stopped first in Cambodia, about which I knew very little. And I absolutely loved Cambodia. And when I got to Vietnam, although it was a very impressive experience, this was, we're talking about 1973, by the way. This is just after the Paris Peace Agreement, so the American soldiers had already left. But there was this kind of interregnum, and there was Vietnam was they had this thing that they called leopard spots, which was at a certain point when peace was declared or a truce was declared, there were bits of the countryside, little spots, were agreed to be under the control of the Viet Cong. And so there was very complex geographical and military geography there. And Saigon was under the control of the South Vietnamese, the American-backed regime. So I stayed there for a bit, then I went to Laos, which is a beautiful place, but which had made kind of, Laos I find the most elusive country. I haven't been back for years and years and years. I think now it's probably full of backpackers, English backpackers doing their gap year, but in those days it was really quite unusual to go up to Luang Prabang, which is where I went, and then back to Cambodia. And when I got back to Cambodia, I settled to live there for a while. Fell ill, and in due course had to go back to England. The money was out, and you know, I couldn't go on living there. But when I got back to England, I couldn't wait to get back to Cambodia. And I realized that something about that country, its situation, its story, really gripped me. And in due course, I picked up the phone, had the New Statesman, and a woman came on the line and said that her name was Margaret Gardner, and she wanted to do something about Vietnam. What she wanted to do was send a reporter there. And would I be interested in going? So I said, yes, I very well would. And I met up with her. And she gave me a cheque for £2,000. So you can see it was meant. Yeah. Except I did say to her actually what I wanted to do was go back to Cambodia. And Cambodia was, well, that was okay for her. She didn't make too sharp a distinction between Cambodia and Vietnam. So I went back. And That was in 74. I stayed in Cambodia till the Lon Nol regime collapsed. And what happened then? If you'd heard the way that we journalists talked about what was happening, I think you'd have been thoroughly shocked, because what happened was, as the city was clearly about to fall, the Americans reached the point where they said, we're going to get out, we're going to evacuate fast. And the Khmer Rouge had said, Khmer Rouge had always killed any journalist that they'd come, any foreign journalist they'd come into contact with. So I wasn't going to stay on there. There were some people who famously stayed on, and that's the film Killing Fields. Those were the people in that were colleagues of mine, braver than me or more reckless than me, who stayed on. But we were absolutely furious, because we thought that the Americans had evacuated too early and they tried to get us out of the story so we wouldn't see what was going on. And we went to the evacuation point on the morning, got into the helicopters and went off to the USS Okinawa in the Gulf of Siam, and from there to Bangkok, and we were furious, absolutely furious with ourselves, sort of with the Americans. Because we walked out on the story, I'd worked in Cambodia waiting to see what happened when the war came to an end. And I was missing it. So then, some of us said, we're going to Saigon then. And Saigon was just about to fall itself, because the advance of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong forces was unstoppable, and the South Vietnam was clearly collapsing. So going to Saigon, and any of us who'd been in Cambodia, what we said was, if we go to Saigon, we're going to stay whatever happens. We'll see what happens when the North Vietnamese come in. And the difference there was that the North Vietnamese, being highly sophisticated at dealing with the world, with world opinion and the world's press and so on, North Vietnamese had said, Western journalists can stay on. They'll be welcome. Nobody's going to harm them. And if there was a worry, which certainly there was, if there was a worry in our minds, it was what the South Vietnamese would do between the moment when the American embassy left, that sort of symbolic moment which was clearly going to come, and when the South Vietnamese forces were defeated, between that moment and the North Vietnamese taking control. Surely, people said, the South Vietnamese army will be very angry, and very angry with any foreigners there, and that could be very dangerous. What we hadn't foreseen was what actually happened, which was that the North Vietnamese, the last Americans left in the morning, and the North Vietnamese were in control by lunchtime. It was incredibly swift. And the South Vietnamese soldiers didn't have time to think. There was a certain amount of, there was anger, there was a lot of anger, they didn't have time to think about foreigners because they were thinking about themselves. And they were thinking, what the hell is going to happen to us? So they were getting out of their uniforms. You may remember, it was this characteristic thing of seeing piles of uniforms in the street, where a soldier had just taken off all his clothes, stripped down to his shorts, and then walked away from his uniform and his weapon and so on, and melted off into the crowd, or got home, or you know, found shelter or something like that. And the North Vietnamese army just came in very fast, and the whole thing was incredibly disciplined, and it worked. By the end of the evening, so Saigon was under North Vietnamese control. Incredible when you think of it, because it's a very big city. I mean, it was huge, and you'd have thought an ungovernable city. They could do it. They had the sort of discipline, they had faith in what they were doing, and they had a kind of prestige. They struck terror into everyone. So don't mess with them. They weren't sort of going around. They probably announced that looters would be shot, but they weren't shooting looters. That wasn't what was happening at all. There had been looting, and then the looting just sort of stopped when they said stop, and then it was over. And then I spent the next three months still in Saigon. Gradually, all the world press left, and then the few of us who were left just hung on until we were frozen out. We were frozen out by all the banks were closed, so you couldn't get any money at all. So in the end, you had to go. You pretended you didn't have to go, but you had to go, and that was it. Back to Luang Prabang, and then.
See, we've spent the last 10 minutes here listening to a very, very well-described, graphic, interesting story. We haven't talked about poetry per se, but I now understand what goes into your poems. People say that you'll take an issue, you'll get in there, you'll go right to the end of this issue, with the exception of one poem, which I'm holding, and I'll give to you in a second, and you sort of explain, I don't know, a moral or philosophical reason from you why certain things happened. So today we're supposed to be, journalism to poetry, but you're explaining to us that the two really do go hand in hand.
Well, in this yes, I mean, absolutely. Of course, in my case, they have. Partly because, one of the things is that you don't write at the time. As a journalist, you write at the time. You are writing while things are going on. You've got a sentence going through your head. You're saying the crowd came in, and you're writing mentally. Because then you've got to get to your typewriter, and you had to in those days get to a type in the days of typewriters, and you had to set it all down. So you would be thinking all the time about what you were going to write. But with poetry, it's not like that. And at the time, I hardly wrote anything about Vietnam or Cambodia, but then afterwards I did. And I wanted to read a poem. Can I read a brief read a poem? I read a poem which was written many, many years afterwards. But it's about Cambodia, and I had I always have a lot of trouble in explaining to myself and to anybody else why the Khmer Rouge had been so terrible and so unlike the Viet Cong, unlike the North Vietnamese, and I think unlike Pathet Lao. This poem, although it sounds a bit like, as we heard earlier, Kipling on acid, it's actually, this is 1973 to 1975. This is the period in which I was in Cambodia, but you will hear that there's a narrative voice in it, which is a Khmer Rouge soldier, so he's on the other side. You practically never saw the Khmer Rouge unless they were dead in those days. Sometimes you did. You'd see, I remember once the river, the Tonle Sap, had, there was a military base on one side and they were firing onto the other side, and you could see the soldiers finally being forced out of their foxholes. And they were incredibly brave, the Khmer Rouge. That was the thing that one thought about them in battle was just, they had nothing. And in, you know, the Lon Nol army didn't have much, but it had an air force. It had a tiny air force. It had World War II planes. They were called T-28s. And it could drop napalm. First of all, they had the Americans on their side. Then they had their air force. And the Khmer Rouge, every year, in the dry season, were attacking Phnom Penh. And they just, wiped out army after army. So that what was left of the Khmer Rouge at the end was a very, very, very embittered group of people who had seen most of their colleagues killed, and that these were the people who came into Phnom Penh and emptied the city with such disastrous consequences. Of course, that was a decision of the Khmer Rouge leading politicians. It wasn't sort of, you know, the average Joe who decided that, but the guys who put that policy into operation had grown up in this dreadful conflict, of which we'd only seen just a tiny amount from our side of the river, as it were. Anyway, this poem is called Out of the East. Out of the south came famine, out of the west came strife, out of the north came a storm cone, and out of the east came a warrior wind, and it struck you like a knife. Out of the east there shone a sun, as the blood rose on the day. And it shone on the work of the warrior wind, and it shone on the heart, and it shone on the soul. And they called the sun dismay. And it's a far cry from the jungle to the city of Phnom Penh. And many try and many die before they can see their homes again. And it's a far cry from the paddy track to the palace of the king. And many go before they know it's a far cry. It's a war cry. Cry for the war that can do this thing. A foreign soldier came to me, and he gave me a gun, and he predicted victory before the year was done. He taught me how to kill a man, he taught me how to try, but he forgot to say to me how an honest man should die. He taught me how to kill a man who was my enemy, but never how to kill a man who'd been a friend to me. You fought the way a hero fights. You had no head for fear, my friend, but you are wounded now, and I'm not allowed to leave you here alive. Out of the east came anger, and it walked a dusty road, and it stopped when it came to a river bank, and it pitched a camp, and it gazed across to where the city stood. When out of the west came thunder, but it came without a sound, for it came at the speed of the warrior wind, and it fell on the heart, and it fell on the soul, and it shook the battleground, and it's a far cry from the cockpit to the foxhole in the clay. And we were a coordinate in a foreign land far away, and it's a far cry from the paddy track to the palace of the king. And many try, and they ask why. It's a far cry. It's a war cry. Cry for the war that can do this thing. Next year the army came for me, and I was sick and thin, and they put a weapon in our hands, and they told us we would win. And they feasted us for 7 days, and they slaughtered 100 cattle. And we sang our songs of victory in the glory of the battle. And they sent us down the dusty roads in the stillness of the night. And when the city heard from us, it burst in a flower of light. The tracer bullets found us out, the guns were never wrong. And the gunship said, regret, regret the words of your victory song. Out of the north came an army, and it was clad in black. And out of the south came a gun crew with 100 shells and a howitzer. And we walked in black along the paddy track, when out of the west came napalm. And it tumbled from the blue, and it spread at the speed of the warrior wind. And it clung to the heart, and it clung to the soul, as napalm is designed to do. And it's a far cry from the fireside to the fire that finds you there, in the foxhole, by the temple gate. The fire that finds you everywhere, and it's a far cry from the paddy track to the palace of the king. And many try, and they ask why. It's a far cry. It's a war cry. Cry for the war that can do this thing. My third year in the army, I was 16 years old, and I had learnt enough, my friend, to believe what I was told. And I was told that we would take the city of Phnom Penh. And they slaughtered all the cows we had, and they feasted us again. And at last we were given river mines, and we blocked the great Mekong. And now we trained our rockets on the landing strip of Pochentong. The city lay within our grasp. We only had to wait. We only had to hold the line by the foxhole, by the temple gate. When out of the west came cluster bombs, and they burst in 100 shards. And every shard was a new bomb, and it burst again upon our men as they gasped for breath in the temple yard. Out of the west came a new bomb, and it sucked away the air. And it sucked at the heart, and it sucked at the soul. And it found a lot of children there. And it's a far cry from the temple yard to the map of the general staff, from the grease pen to the gasping men, to the wind that blows the soul like chaff. And it's a far cry from the paddy track to the palace of the king. And many go before they know it's a far cry. It's a war cry. Cry for the war that has done this thing. A foreign soldier came to me, and he gave me a gun. And the liar spoke of victory before the year was done. Oh, what would I want with victory in the city of Phnom Penh? Punish the city, punish the people. What would I want but punishment? We have brought the king home to his palace. We shall leave him there to weep. And we'll go back along the paddy track, for we have promises to keep. For the promise made in the foxhole, for the oath in the temple yard. For the friend I killed in the battlefield, I shall make that punishment hard. Out of the south came famine, out of the west came strife, out of the north came a storm cone, and out of the east came a warrior wind, and it struck you like a knife. Out of the east there shone a sun as the blood rose on the day, and it shone on the work of the warrior wind, and it shone on the heart, and it shone on the soul. And they called the sun dismay, my friend. They called the sun dismay.
Beautiful, James. Ladies and gentlemen, what we'll do in just a couple of minutes is take any questions you'd like to ask of James. But if you wouldn't mind, I'd just like to wrap up with something that will mean at least something to pretty much everybody in this room. And somebody wrote a little note to me the other day, and it said, one of the few times in his writing, at least recently, when he's angry and outraged, without any mask of irony or deflection towards intellectualism. And although one poem, which is purely material, in the sense that it deals with the here and the now and the end in itself, and not a conduit to a philosophical reflection. And the poem is Tiananmen. I wonder if you would mind.
June 15th, 1989. So not the same day as the Tiananmen massacre. This was the day that I wrote it, and I wrote it actually, one reason why the form is quite simple is I wrote it as a song lyric, and I went out. I wanted to copy the form of a famous Billie Holiday song, Strange Fruit. I went out into Kowloon, found a tape of Strange Fruit, went back to the hotel, played it, wrote down the words, worked out the form, and I just mentioned this because it's a kind of technical point. If you write a song lyric, you write it so that it can, in principle, be set to music. And if you copy the form of a song, then in principle, you've done it simply enough. It should be possible to set to music. So this one is called Tiananmen. Tiananmen is broad and clean, and you can't tell where the dead have been. And you can't tell what happened then. And you can't speak of Tiananmen. You must not speak. You must not think. You must not dip your brush in ink. You must not say what happened then, what happened there in Tiananmen. The cruel men are old and deaf, ready to kill but short of breath. And they will die like other men, and they'll lie in state in Tiananmen. They lie in state, they lie in style. Another lie is thrown on the pile by the cruel men to cleanse the blood from Tiananmen. Truth is a secret, keep it dark. Keep it dark in your heart of hearts. Keep it dark till you know when truth may return to Tiananmen. Tiananmen is broad and clean, and you can't tell where the dead have been, and you can't tell when they'll come again. They'll come again to Tiananmen.
Thank you. If anybody would like to ask James any questions, just stick your hands up and ask away anything you like.
Took a trip to Malaysian Borneo with Redmond O'Hanlon that he wrote a very charming account about. In the account, you seem to be depressed and eating salted fish and reading Victor Hugo the whole time. I wonder if in fact that's an accurate picture of your experience.
Okay. It's a wonderful book, and it's a wonderful example of a brilliantly slanted account of travel. This is this book called Into the Heart of Borneo by Redmond O'Hanlon. And we certainly weren't, neither of us had time to be depressed. We started laughing at the beginning of the journey upstream, and we laughed and laughed and laughed all day long, because first of all, we were hysterical at the thought that we were actually doing this thing of going up from, you're going up way into, it wasn't uncharted territory, by the way, but it was way beyond the normal route, because in order to get, the point of the journey was to go and see some real tropical rainforest before it was cut down. And the bit that we went to was the real thing, and I believe it has since been logged, alas. The bit we went through showed, you know, what would happen to it when it was logged, but then we got to it. Reading Victor Hugo, yes, I was, and the reason for that was it was work that I brought with me, which was I had to read Les Miserables, because I was
going to work on the translation of a French musical that had been done in a sort of stadium concert performance that was going to be done in London. And so I was about to start work on that thing. Now that is another story, and in the end I was sacked from that, although they've actually retained some of my work. So I have, you know, a little part of my work is in Les Misérables. But that was what I was doing as we went upstream. But of course, I wasn't as unaware of what was going on around me as perhaps Redmond likes to imply. It was a wonderful trip, and it was the first time Redmond had been to the tropics, and the first time in his married life that he'd been away from his wife for one night. So it was more of an adventure, for an unusual adventure for him than it was for me. But what I had planned was to go to Saba and to go walking from Longhouse to Longhouse. I'd met somebody in Thailand, where I'd been recently, who told me how to do it. And I sort of listened to this guy. So I told Redmond what the plan was. And then Redmond upped the ante and said, no, Saba isn't so interesting. We really want to go. And his plan was we were going to go up the river on the Malaysian side, and then our servants were going to carry the boat across the mountains, and we were going to get into it on the Indonesian side and go down that side and be the first people to cross Borneo. Ha! I had a map of Borneo and I could see the rapids on the far side. Anyway, I said to Regan, if we cross from Malaysia into Indonesia, at that bit of the border, we'll be shot by the Indonesians. That made absolutely no difference to Regan. He was convinced that we could do this thing. But I sort of knew that we wouldn't actually get far enough for that, because for a start, nobody was going to carry a boat for us. Whose boat was it, and how were we going to give it back at the end, and so on and so forth. So what we did do, which is an absolutely amazing thing to me, looking back on it now, particularly looking back on it since 9/11, was we took a gun from Heathrow. We arrived at Heathrow. We said, here's our luggage. That case there has cartridges, and that case there is the gun. The people at Heathrow said, yes, lads, so we take the gun, and that goes with the pilot, and you'll get it in Singapore. We took a gun into Singapore. I couldn't believe it. I'd been convinced that Redmond would be stopped at Heathrow. You know, you can't just take a gun on a plane. But they thought we were members of the SS. They definitely did. And SAS. They thought, oh yeah, it's a couple of, you know. And this is presumably how they travel. So we got to Singapore. We arrived in Singapore. And here we are. This is here's our luggage. We're on our way to Kuching. And that's our gun. Guys in Singapore said, yeah, that's fine. We hold on to the gun while you're here for a weekend in Singapore. You said, yes.
Raffles Hotel?
Yes, Raffles Hotel. Yeah, well, we're going to hold on for the gun, onto the gun, and when you come back for the next leg of the journey, you can have the gun. I thought, this isn't my idea of the Singapore of Lee Kuan Yew. That was pretty important. But we spent our weekend at Raffles, got back, handed in the chit, we were given our gun back. Got on the plane. I mean, then they took it, stowed it on the plane, arrived in Kuching, this sort of little hut about the size, customs hut about the size of this room, and the counter, and it said, here's this, here's this, here's this, and we're going up the river, and we're going to shoot our food, go to the center of Borneo, and here's our gun. And the guy said, you're what? And finally, there was somebody who made sense, finally. And he said, there's absolutely no way you're going to take a gun into Kuching, into Borneo, that's that. Redmond was crestfallen. I was incredibly relieved, just incredibly relieved. And the gun was kept, and later we took it back, same process, back through Singapore, amazingly it all worked, back to Heathrow, and back to Oxfordshire.
There's a notion of you being drag kicking and screaming in this book, but apparently you bought the tickets, right? For the whole thing in the first place.
Oh, yeah, I set the whole thing up, yes. I mean, I set the whole thing up, and...
You've blown it now.
yes, but what did happen, but, you see, I would have just gone to South, and I would have done a sensible walking trip with one backpack. I wouldn't have done the extraordinary journey that we did do. So, you know, and then afterwards, Redmond got a bit between his teeth, and then he started going to the Amazon and so on.
All over the place. We're nearly out of time here, James. Any more questions, ladies and gentlemen? Let's have a couple of quickies, shall we?
This may not be quick, but as someone who's probably been on both sides of the fence, what difference does it make what you write about as a poet? You've had experience of some of the most historic events, some of the most remarkable dramatic situations of the modern times. You have other poets who sit in campuses for decade after decade and churn out book after book. How do the differences work? What are the consequences of the poetry, and especially what, if any, are there any critical differences that make good poetry out of either situation?
Well, yeah, as you say, that is a very big question. And I would say, I always thought that poetry really should be about something. And I didn't always think that, because I had a phase of writing kind of nonsense poetry, and I love nonsense poetry, and so that by definition is more or less about, it's almost about nothing. It sort of gives you the impression. I mean, Jabberwocky is clearly about a contest between a man and a beast, but it's almost about nothing. But with modernism, yes, and with a lot of contemporary poetry, one would feel that it's not about very much. I think that to have a subject matter, to be given a subject matter, be given in the sense of be given it by experience, it's the beginning of a big problem. And what you do with it, or whether it defeats you, if you give it a big subject, whether it defeats you or you manage something with it, is absolutely unclear when you sit down.
We are out of time. I'm very, very sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. James Fenton.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. James Fenton, and also thank you very much, Phil, for your facilitation. So we have prepared some souvenirs for both of you, and may I ask Mr. Peter Upton, Director of British Council Hong Kong, to present the souvenirs.
Can I just add our own personal thanks to James for what was a remarkable performance, both of reading the poetry, thank you very much for that, and for something that's so evocative and powerful, but also for those wonderful anecdotes. I'm still working the idea of an SAS-style professor of poetry from Oxford, so it's an image that will stay with me for a long time. James, thank you very much. And this is for Phil, because, of course, being the sort of straight guy to James is never quite so easy, and he does it with great style and aplomb. So, obviously, a great media star. Phil, thank you. And once again, my thanks to the FCC, to Peter, my thanks to you, to my colleagues from the British Council, and particularly from James. It's good to know that there is life in poetry and journalism still. Thank you very much. Have a great evening.
So thank you very much for coming, and I'm sure many of you would like to ask Mr. Fenton for his signature. So we have a book signing session afterwards, and we are also serving coffee and tea outside, and you can have a drink and have a relaxed Saturday afternoon. Before you go, please may I remind you to return your questionnaires to us, and your feedback is very important to us. And once again, thank you for coming, and have a nice weekend. Thank you.